Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Season 3, Episode 4 of Mind Clickers, where it's time to click both heads in 2021. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest who I'm very excited to chat to, and that is Benjamin. Benjamin is a part-time performance coach, and he's working with chess players on physical and mental preparation. He has a PhD in physics and 15 years of experience as a data scientist. Today, we're going to talk about his work with chess players, his approach to coaching, and more. So, nice to meet you, Benjamin.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be on the podcast, on the show. It's fantastic. Really looking forward to the conversation.
No worries. I'm really looking forward to it as well. To be honest, I've played a little bit of chess in the past, but definitely nowhere near the amount that you've played. So I guess I'm really excited to jump in and learn everything about it, especially the mindset and mentality component of it, which is something that I've always been thinking about. So I guess what we'll do is we'll kick it off with a bit of bit about yourself and your background and I guess how you got into chess as well.
Sure. My background is as a scientist. I have a PhD in physics, and then I left physics to work as a data scientist in the in the finance world. And I've been doing this for almost 20 years now. Wow. So. And you know, I've always been into sports and you know, quantified self and so on. But working with numbers on a day-to-day basis, I really wanted to do something that was more about helping others. Mm. And that's why I got attracted to coaching.
Yeah.
The science, the sports science part, I mostly learned myself. But like for the, you know, the whole mental aspect, I thought this was not something I felt that I could acquire on my own. Yep. So I did a 1 year part-time degree to just like learn some basic tools. I mean, you know, by the way, I'm not a sports psychologist and don't pretend to be one, but I wanted to know, you know, get a few basic tools to help out people, and that's my journey.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess coming from a background in data science, have you been able to formulate many links between that? So say, for example, when you're working with a lot of numbers and now obviously chess, you know, I'd imagine there's a lot of numbers in there as well. So can you find like different angles in that as well?
Yeah, so I started out actually with the idea of like, oh, I'm going to be a very quantitative coach in terms of like, you know, data and stuff. And yeah. Actually, as soon as I started, I realized that I almost did like a 180 degree turn the other way around. As in like, data is valuable, but it's not, it's a guide, right? You don't follow your GPS because it drives you into a lake. So it's definitely a case that if I want to like recommend like an intervention, I would never do that without like the assurance that data is backing it up, right? Like you know, I wouldn't tell someone like, oh yeah, you should take like, for example, a vitamin D supplement if they are not like vitamin D deficient. Right. Well, and first of all, maybe I'd let a medical professional do that recommendation in the first place. But you see where I'm coming from, right? In terms of like the proper use of data, but data is a powerful thing to get feedback from, right? Like, okay, if someone like if you keep like a simple log, doesn't have to be even digital or anything, but of your the times you go to bed, you wake up, and your weight, it can be a very powerful tool to make you. Act, and in the end, as coaches, we all want to, like, you know, induce behavior changes in our athletes. So I think data is a useful tool in as one of many tools.
For sure, definitely, and it kind of, you know, brings me kind of flashbacks towards when I did data science at uni. And I guess, has there been many situations where the data is saying one thing, but your intuition and your kind of gut feeling saying something else?
No, it's the problem is mostly like data where it's not quite clear what it's about, like heart rate variability, for example.
Gotcha.
And we can come back to this if we talk about recovery later. But yeah. It's a case of like, okay, now, what does it mean on a daily basis? Like, okay, in the morning, then you can kind of use it as a baseline of like how you feel for the day and like yep. what your load is. But what does it mean directly after after exercise or after a game in terms of is this like an adequate gauge of so I guess there's a lot of like research to be done. And mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it's like, okay, you've got this data, but you're not quite sure what to do with it. And this can also be a lot of hype in terms of like, that's the thing you have to look at. But, you know, these things take time, like, you know, just like the first heart rate monitors to really get like a good grasp of like how to use that data. And there's still a lot of progress to be done there.
For sure. Now, you mentioned briefly you did a little bit of sports science as well. So I guess, did you work within the sports field much at all, or was it more so just within that previous kind of data field and then going into the mental coaching?
No, I didn't work at least directly. I have experience with just doing mostly endurance sports myself.
Like
running, cycling, a bit of triathlon. And yep. then a bit of resistance training. And what I like is I'm able to read the research directly. And I think that's very useful because often like the research is going to be digested by journalists and then it's going to be into, you know, one of these very popular pop psychology book. And, you know, I have nothing against journalists, but sometimes, you know, being able to look at a study and see, you know, oh, yeah, maybe actually this results is like a small sample or it's not so relevant. I think this is very useful. But it's not about all about the research because sometimes, you know, elite athletes often are, you know, ahead of the research.
Yeah.
You know, one example is like bodybuilders. You know, they've been ahead of the strengths and conditioning research for a bit, right? So it's about using the research but knowing its limitation as well. And I think my background really helps me to that aspect.
For sure, definitely. I love that research approach because, you know, there are a lot of coaches nowadays or, you know, even data scientists who don't always tend to go the research approach. And I think being able to have that kind of predominant research approach allows you to just have a little bit more credibility, right? Because that just helps with your case at the end of the day.
Yeah, in the end, it's like you need to get buy-in from your athlete. Having some solid scientific and not just like, yeah, I've seen it somewhere on the internet that's what you should do. But actually like point out to like just the abstract of an article and often like people will be quite interested in that. Plus often there's like, I don't know if you know there's this Twitter account, I think it's like Say It's in Mice and it's about, you know, there's like lots of studies, but they're just in mice and then people take it out of context and, it turns out that actually mice are different from humans and you can make them like, you know, do a whole variety of things. You know, you can cure obesity like 100 different ways in mice, but journalists are quite keen to like, you know, take something that is in mice and then like just bring it up for humans. And that's just not quite how it works.
Yeah. That's kind of funny. Cause I remember back in undergrad when I was doing my sports science and, yeah, I remember the teacher or the lecturer bringing up that some of the students in the previous year actually took articles that were predominantly focused around mice because they didn't actually read the article properly. So, yeah, it's definitely very funny when people kind of make that mistake and it's like, what are you doing? Now, obviously, you know, I'd love to base this episode around chess. So I guess how did you get into chess and what's your journey from the chess from the start?
Well, I think I've always been like a games player.
Yep.
I really grew up with video games, you know, the Nintendo. And then when I got 12, I got the Super Nintendo when it came out. And then like moved on to PC gaming as a teenager.
Yep.
So then I kind of like during my university year was not into gaming so much, but really got into board gaming afterwards. You know, modern strategy board games. You know, we call them like German style games, but obviously they don't all come from Germany anymore. And then met all chess almost by accident. I mean, I kind of knew how the pieces moved before, but never really played. And you know, it's one of these games that just warm itself into your head, and it's quite hard, difficult to get rid of. I mean, it's just such a deep and wonderful game. So I've loved, you know, playing as a club player. You know, definitely I'm just average strengths. Nothing exceptional whatsoever. It's very difficult as an adult improver, but it's also extremely interesting to learn, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how am I going to get better as a, because, of course, like, young people have, you know, higher plasticity. They will absorb, you know, new concepts, way faster. But it's still possible as an adult. The thing is, often life is in the way. It's like, okay, it's going to take, you know, many hours to improve from whatever level you are. And do you really want to do this knowing that, you know, you've got like a family and work commitments. But it's definitely extremely interesting to get on this journey of improvement.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Definitely. And, you know, I think that's fantastic. I think that kind of backline story for your chess has really kind of set you up to, you know, really just be experienced within that kind of scene. I think that's what makes it so interesting.
Yeah. So that's, it's kind of like almost, you know, things, the pieces kind of moved together, like, and were fitting very nicely. I was there was a one of the elite players that I was quite a fan of, and I could see from interviews and reading here and there that he was a little bit struggling with his lifestyle and his sleep. So I kind of like put together like a small document and you know, got in touch. And I didn't get to like work with him directly, but that kind of set me on the path to like, maybe I should actually contact like other players. And then eventually I got really lucky that a member of the World Elite agreed to work with me. And we've been working for like more than a year now together.
Fantastic.
So it's been a great journey.
Yeah, for sure. I'd only imagine how much experience you got directly working with him. So that's fantastic. You know, I guess I've played chess very, very, very briefly, I guess, you know, just on chess.com. But I guess the biggest question I have is, what makes chess so, I guess, fundamentally hard? Like, obviously, there's different complexity levels, but I guess what makes it so hard to, and you, what makes chess so hard? And I guess, can you fully master it, do you think?
The thing is, like, if you think chess is hard, you have to realize that chess is hard at any level.
Right.
And if you look at, you know, even Magnus Carlsen was like really by some margin the best player maybe to ever play the game. It's also hard for him, and you know, he will miss things sometimes. Of course, a lot less than other people, but still happens, right? So it's an interesting question why it is so hard. It's just, it's just the complexity of it, the mental process you need to have, because I think it's there's a lot of like fixed things, as in there's a set of knowledge and rules that you need to absorb, but at the same time, you need to be prepared to break them all the time, because it's a concrete game, and like, the rules are not worth anything if like they don't apply in a particular position, and so it's like, I think the combination of these two makes the game like extremely deep, because you need the knowledge and you need like you know, the adaptability, and of course there's like pure visualization skills that that need to be trained. But I think that's what makes it so difficult.
For sure. And do you think, you know, now that I think about it, like comparing esports to chess, there's so many different crossovers, right? But the biggest crossover that I was just thinking about is this whole idea of intimidation, because you're sitting directly in front of your opponent. So do you think intimidation plays a factor as well?
Yeah, well, of course. I think any factor of, like, you know, all the psychological factors that you'd have in traditional sports, any sports, are really there and even magnified in chess. Definitely. Body language is huge. Of course, there's you can find like lots of great photos of players with, you know, killer stares. I could send you a couple for the show notes. And for example, you know, Garry Kasparov, who's like also one of the greatest players ever, is very is retired now, but you know, is famous for his like extreme confidence and body language, and definitely not one for it's poker face, as in like there's on rare instances when he's made like big mistakes, it's like you can clearly see it on his face. But it's super interesting that you get to sit directly in front of your opponent.
For sure, definitely. I think it definitely adds that extra bit of stress, I'd say, to the game, because you're, you know, as you said, seeing someone's body language, and the poker face really comes into play, whether someone's feeling confident or not confident, motivated, or, you know, has that even underlying belief that they can easily win or not. It all comes down to, I guess, how they see themselves and how they position themselves mentally. So that, I think that really makes it interesting as well.
Definitely.
Now, I guess one thing that I also wanted to quickly touch on was, I guess, the length of the games. Because obviously you can have games that could be, you could sit down and they could be over within a couple of minutes, but then you have games that could be over within a couple of hours. So I think, you know, how do players have that mindset that the game could, you know, all this preparation could be, you know, over in 5 minutes, or it could take hours. And, you know, if a game goes for hours and they make one mistake, you know, how crucial is that towards mindset?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's important for first of all, let's separate like the online and over the board, or we call it, because online, of course, online really lends itself more to like fast action.
Gotcha.
So like, you know, games that are like minutes, and then people also online like to play what's called bullet chess, which is the fastest time control, where, for example, players will have just 1 minute for making all their moves. What's called in chess, you have something called the increment, where you make a move and then it's like a little bit of extra time. And for example, you may or may not have that in bullet chess. So it's like extremely fun to watch. And this is where like people that are really good at this, they've also been signed by esports team on their roster. Somebody like Andrew Tang, who's like, you know, a strong grandmaster by all standards, but definitely not in the world elite. But at bullet chess, is one of the best, right? And even you know, on par with Magnus and Hikaru, and he's been signed by Cloud9, and Hikaru, of course, was one of the best players, is part of TSM. So that's like the super fast realm. And then over the board, there's like mainly three time control. So you've got like Blitz, which is like about 5 minutes each. You've got Rapid, which is like about 30 minutes each. Yep. And then you've got Classical, which is like the longest time control. And it's like the king of categories, as in like for the World Championship. It's going to be like many games of classical chess. And this will be definitely, you know, it kind of varies a little bit, because after a while in the game, after 40 moves, you get more time. So there's like this little element. But it can easily be 4, 6, 7 hours So, and as you say, what's important is like, it doesn't matter if you make 60 good moves and one mistake, like that, the one mistake will destroy everything you've accrued over the 60 good moves. So this is why chess is also so unforgiving. It's like, there's just, it's just some mistakes you can try to recover, of course, but there are mistakes you just absolutely can't recover from. And that's so brutal. But in terms of like, the focus aspect, it's extremely interesting. It's like, how do you help someone to sustain concentration and focus over 6 hours?
Exactly. Yeah. And I guess that kind of has correlation towards, you know, maybe esports in a way where teams might play a best of seven, for example, in League of Legends, where games could go for, you know, 45 minutes each. In between that, they get, you know, minimal breaks. So it's kind of like constant as well. And I guess that is a factor for inducing that mental fatigue or cognitive fatigue that we're kind of going on a tangent about. But it's very interesting. Yeah, it's just the fact that, you know, you could be spending 4 hours and then you slip up, you lose concentration, you lose focus for a split second, and there goes the game.
And it's this, if you play a rapid play, so like say, you know, 15 minutes per player, and then like you can have like, you know, 5-6 games in an afternoon. So that kind of like looks like the esports format a little bit that you're mentioning. Players usually say that there's a lot of extra fatigue involved in that, because you get to restart afresh every game. So it's like you need to refocus, think about another opponent, another set of strategies, and that can be like, you know, plus you have to absorb the emotional impact of, you know, having just lost or won before. And that's obviously extra mental fatigue to absorb. We can talk about the similarities with esports later on, but I think esports are huge and even way ahead of chess and what chess players are doing.
For sure. And I guess just touching on that speed, the speed kind of game mode, I guess the importance of, I guess, playing in that mode is kind of favoring speed and accuracy, right? Yeah, so say, for example, when you're playing online, because obviously those your short games aren't really in person, but it's also important to, I guess, be precise as well and speedy.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely an element of, you know, mouse dexterity for this. It's definitely super interesting to see, you know, chess evolve as any sport. Because right now, this bullet format is not recognized by the International Federation. Right. So the championships are, you know, there's like an official world championship, but they're organized by platforms like, you know, Elite Chess or chess.com or chess24. I'm going to mention all of them. it's kind of like, you know, unofficial, but would it be like, I mean, clearly the evolution would be one day for the International Federation to recognize one of these championship because, you know, that's it's a fun format to watch, and that's the future.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's really interesting because I remember watching Twitch a little while ago, and there's a lot more streamers who started to do, you know, play chess as well. So do you think that kind of had a really positive impact on the scene, or had a negative impact?
Yeah, just before, like, chess players are like crying in despair. I'm not saying that bullet is going to replace, you know, classical chess, because classical chess will always be the king of format. But there is room for everything, I think. And there is room for, like, you know, the bullet as well. In terms of, like, you know, Twitch has been huge. There was the pandemic is obviously a horrendous event and brought a lot of pain for many people, but it's brought a lot of growth to chess. There was a first boom in March 2020, and then there was another second boom with the Queen's Gambit release, you know, the Netflix show in November. And I think it's almost like, you know, doubling of player overnight with the Queen's Gambit, something like this. Yeah. I mean, I don't have the numbers on the top of my head, but this is what we're looking at. So there's been a few content creators that have been really good into producing content to appeal to the new players coming to the game, you know, both on Twitch and YouTube. You know, like, for example, a YouTuber like Levi Rosman managed to produce some great content at the right moment. And, you know, it's rightly so, it's been very successful. And on Twitch, the game also is taking off with, like, you know, many popular streamers, you know, both male and female, which is good to see, like, you know, a little bit of balance. So it's been a fantastic year for the growth of chess.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, you know, because that has kind of established itself within Twitch, I can only see it just progressively growing bigger and bigger.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I mean, that's going to be really exciting to see how that works. And you know, all the different kind of small tournaments that come out of it, for sure.
Yeah, definitely, you know, seeing like more people coming to actual chess clubs because they've seen a taste of the game, but it's great if we can translate this into more more players. And maybe it's a great opportunity to make, you know, clubs more welcoming, more attractive to new players, you know, not intimidating. And it's definitely for my club, the Hammersmith Chess Club in London, we're definitely trying to be, you know, very welcoming and inclusive.
For sure. Fantastic. I love that. Another thing that I wanted to touch on briefly was this. Now, I saw a YouTube video the other day, and it was really interesting, the fact that there was kind of a suggestion regarding calorie burning for chess players due to the cognitive stress and element of it. Now, I don't know how true that is, but I wonder if, you know, what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, it all started with an ESPN article about maybe 2 years ago.
Right, okay.
And it's a scientist who he gave a number to a journalist and he said, like, yeah, don't really use that number. It's kind of like, I'm not too sure. And of course, like that was like what's brought at the headline. And unfortunately, he used like some studies from the 70s was like completely outdated. So this is kind of like maybe the hill I'm going to die on. So the article mentions like that playing chess could burn up to 6,000 calories per day. Yeah. And obviously, you know, that's like, you know, Tour de France, mountain stage type of energy expenditure, and it's definitely not absolutely not the case. There was also Pollard did an experiment where the idea would be to have people fitted with heart rate monitors, and that you could see. I don't know if you have such things in any sports, maybe to like you know, make the broadcast more interesting and displaying some players' biological metrics. But anyway, they use like this to derive some numbers of calorie burning. But the thing is, just because your heart rate is elevated doesn't mean that you're using a lot of energy, right? When the watch has to be, you know, calibrated to reflect that. So both this like 6,000 calories and this like this polar number of 560 calories per hour, they're actually not accurate. Now the thing is that the brain actually it's not like the brain goes into a special mode once you start to think hard. It's like your brain actually is always, you know, using roughly the same amount of energy. Yeah. There have been actual studies where, okay, we make people play chess or play sports. There's like a recent German study which is about exactly about esports measure answering this exact question. Yeah. And by measuring you know, the oxygen content, the breathing, this will tell you exactly what people are using energetically, right? Because okay, maybe your heart rate is elevated, but actually your if your oxygen consumption is not high, then there is no energy expenditure in there. So definitely chest burns a little bit of calories, but it's like it's really quite quite moderate. So
quite moderate.
I guess it's probably the same numbers that you would have in esport.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's it's really interesting because that's one of the things, you know, as you mentioned it, that I really want to do eventually when I can, I guess, be with players in person is start to track those underlying physiological values for players, whether that be heart rate, whether that be oxygen output, just really understanding where they start to stress and how that kind of impacts their gameplay as well, because I think there's a lot of crossover variables that could be considered there. So it's always definitely a really interesting area of research that I'm, you know, potentially keen on in the future. But yeah, it's always been one of those things where it's like, I think I saw an article ages ago that's like the average gamer burns X amount of calories by sitting at the computer in a tournament for a couple of hours. And it's just like, well, yeah, probably not. But, you know, where's the research to really back that up? And I think that's the problem nowadays where someone says something and then it's like, okay, that's automatically the truth. But there's no kind of evidence to really back that up, which can be a bit of a problem sometimes.
Yeah, I think unfortunately this 6,000 calories number, it got like a life of its own. And because it came from it was in an ESPN article, like, you know, it is. And really the shame of it is like the article that it's in is actually really good. Like the rest of the article, because it really, you know, mentioned, or like chess players are, now, you know, they're more like athletes. They take like their sports and everything quite seriously. So with that aspect, it's like a really super interesting article. It's just like that bit of information in there, which was, you know, maybe to bring up a little more clicks, or was a little bit, you know, attractive. And it just, you just won't get rid of it now.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. Now, another kind of thing that I was really interested in as well is kind of this idea that it's very much prevalent in esports as well, is this idea of anxiety and, you know, overcoming anxiety, whether that be in a tournament setting, whether that be even online if you're playing at home. But I think in-person anxiety would be a little bit more prevalent because you'd have those kind of factors that, you know, induce that a little bit more, like intimidation, how I chatted about that earlier. But I guess, you know, how do you help, you know, players to I guess overcome that anxiety and to kind of reduce it?
Yeah. Well, there was this this super interesting saying by I think the sports psychologist Michael Gervais is like, okay, you've got two approaches. It's either there is such a thing as a big game and you approach it like this, or there is no such thing as a big game. Which is kind of paradoxical, but is leaning towards the thing that there's no such thing as a big game, and I would also fall on this part. And what do I mean is like it's really focusing on the present. You know, if you've got the discipline to, you know, treat every game with the respect it's due, and you know, doing your best and so on. The final is just another one of these games, right? So, and how you do this is, well, it's really about, you know, focusing on what you can control and be in the present, right? So to be in the present is something that it's not something you're gonna invent on the day of the final, right? It's something that you cultivate all the time. And there's definitely, you know, exercises to do that. To also among the I've learned a lot of techniques to physiologically recenter yourself in your zone of like optimal performance. And and definitely, you know, if you're a little bit overexcited through particular breathing, you can calm yourself down, or if you're like a little bit bored, you can like hype yourself a little bit up also through breathing. And these are super powerful. I really love breathing because it's a physiological thing. So it's like you do it, well, things have to happen. You can't just not film countdown if you do your breathing properly. So that makes it like, you know, a really powerful powerful tool. But definitely, you know, that's where I drove, you know, from meditation, because it's about you know, your self-talk, you know, we all have self-talk, and and for athletes, you know, it can be it's quite an important part of you know, who you are and how you approach the game. And it's definitely what you don't want is like unwanted self-talk, which would be, you know, negative or something like this. And definitely, you know, meditation being like the awareness of your thought and the control of this awareness is definitely, you know, a prime tool to use in your toolbox to bring this unwanted self-talk under control. So I'd say, like, to summarize a little bit of a convoluted answer, it's like there's like, you know, being in the present, which is about you know, meditation is huge, and also all sorts of breathing exercises, which you know, whether your mind wants it or not, they're gonna reset you to be in the appropriate arousal situation, so to speak.
For sure, definitely. And I think that you know, I love that because I think there's a lot of crossovers within traditional sport, esports, you know, and even chess as well. So I think that there's a lot of crossovers that really entail this whole idea of being in the moment, being present. And I really like that there's no big game. There's only the big game that you kind of, you know, if there's no big game, you know, and it's kind of brings about that kind of mindset that you know, the big game is just in your head, and you're kind of positioning that this game is the big game, building up the tolerance towards understanding, you know, whether it be a big tournament or whether it be, you know, the Worlds, for example. It's all about understanding the previous preparation that's been put in place and acknowledging that you can't really change anything right now, but it's always just about being in the present and just, you know, using those breathing techniques and positive self-talk. Definitely. You know, I've had a lot of positive experience with using positive self-talk with a lot of my previous players and even guys in traditional sport. And it's always a good one for sure. So I love that.
Yeah. And then, it's definitely in sports, it's about, these are techniques that really you can use cross like many things. And, and even like, it's just like the implementation. For example, a basketball player, you can make that person feel the dimples on the ball just before a free throw as a as a way to like, okay, I am present, I can feel the ball, rather than thinking like, oh, if I lose, I will. So it's about, okay, someone else is not gonna have a ball to feel in their hand, but you can you just find the equivalent technique to make them, you know, maybe go in their body to feel the present moment.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. And I love that kind of mindset. Now, I guess in regards to your specific coaching, so what is your, I guess, specific coaching entail? Does that, you know, account for, you know, mental prep in game day stuff? Does that account for, you know, even healthy lifestyle? You know, what are the sorts of things you do with your player?
Yeah, so it's basically we treat like the big objectives in the year the way an endurance athlete would prepare for big objectives. So it's like a year-long periodization program in terms of like, okay, this is, you know, blocks of increasing work with like, you know, some kind of... It's like a loose plan because obviously, you know, you adapt it constantly, but there is a plan in place. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is like the physical side, because just to be like physically fit is huge. And than like the mental side. So it's about, you know, because also all the mental techniques, they are not like something you learn like the day before the game, right? It's like you need to practice them all the time, because, you know, if you don't practice your breathing, or you know, if you teach your athlete ways to deal with positive self-talk, like they need to use it when they're on the ladder on training games, because otherwise they're not going to be used to it. So it's about exercise periodization, lifestyle, and you know, and about lifestyle, you know, there's a lot of you know, like the sleep, the nutrition, and you know, and the mental prep and the physical prep. And I don't pretend to have all the answers, you know. I'm not like an expert in everything. I know my limitations, and you know, I'm always prepared to you know, refer the athlete to someone else who's an expert. Or also as a coach, sometimes you've got to say like, look, I don't know, right? Like a coach doesn't have to have all the answers. But the thing is, you need to be able to say, I don't know, but I'm going to look into this for the next time, and then do the research and then come back with the answers.
For sure. Definitely. And I think that's really important to not really step outside your scope of practice, because I think that a lot of coaches potentially do that, whether that be, you know, say, for example, strictly a psychologist, but then they're doing exercise prescription. It's like, well, you know, that's kind of like the crossover, so it's kind of a bit different. But you know, I definitely think that there are a lot of coaches that I've chatted to in the past, you know, even before MindClickers, back in my Call of Duty and StarCraft days, where it's kind of like they're trying to take on all the roles at once. But I definitely think if you do that, you know, it's just not the most appropriate thing to do.
Yeah, this is why, you know, I really didn't feel comfortable to do any kind of mental prep just off the back of like books and articles. And I felt like, okay, I need to do some kind of degree to really be taught by experts, because otherwise I'm really like out of my depth.
Yeah, for sure. That's fantastic. Now, I guess, you know, how do you take someone to be a better player? And I know it's an interesting question, because it's like, well, it depends on their skill level, of course. But I guess, you know, say for example, what do you look for in a player? And do you think, okay, I can help you improve this area, I can help you work on this, you know, this is within our annual plan for this year, and let's like focus on this time. Where do you make those decisions, and how do you make them?
Well, that's interesting. It's like, should coaches have philosophies? You know, sometimes it's like, oh yeah, as a coach, you need to have a philosophy. And I think as a coach, you need to have guiding principles more than philosophies, as in like, okay, I'm, for example, one of mine would be, I'm evidence-based, and I'm, you know, I pay attention to data, and this is going to guide all my a lot of my decisions. But at the end of the day, the athletes kind of, he wants something from you, and then, you have to, bring that what he wants. Now he might know the way to do this, but most likely he's coming to you because you will know better how to implement the method to bring the results that he wants.
Yeah.
Right. So I just it's about you know, you need to really listen to your athletes and bring what he wants, and at the same time try to do what's best in terms of, you know, if you need to do a lifetime intervention that he had not thought of, then you need to. This is where you have to, you know, have buy-in, and that's a huge thing. Now, to answer your question a bit more precisely, I think improvements about, especially chess, it's about working hard. So I don't deal with like, you know, making the players better chess players. I help them to be better people, you know, fitter in their optimal, you know, with all the tools on the physical and mental side. And then like they have to do their own chess work. I think it's a huge thing because how to improve at chess, you know, there's so many people discussing this, and there's no like plan. I mean, you have like training plans, but it's not like once, it's never one size fits all. And the only common thing is like you need to go beyond your comfort zone, right? So it's about, okay, like say in a practice game, are you going to try to, are you just going to play casually? Or are you really going to be focused and try to improve? And then once you finish that game, do you go back to it and analyze it? Or do you just click next and just like, you know, go on? So there's definitely, you know, but in, you know, in any game, and definitely, for example, you know, when I play StarCraft, I know you're a StarCraft player as well. I know full well I'm not... I'm playing casually and I'm not going to try to improve. And, you know, I just don't, it's not my goal to put in the effort. But then like, if you don't put the effort and your goal is to improve, then there's like a big discrepancy.
Yeah. Bit of a disconnection.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess, you know, you touched on it very briefly there, but just the fact of watching back replays. Now, obviously, within esports and, you know, pretty much even traditional sports, you know, watching back replays is crucial, especially whether that be watching the back individually or with a team, just so you can really understand what went wrong and, you know, how we can look to fix that towards the future. So I guess, is that the same for chess players where they, I guess, go back and watch move by move? What could have went differently? What could they have done differently? And is that kind of... Is it kind of like, you know, kind of not really soul crushing, but say, for example, you play for 6 hours, you made all the right moves, and then you make one wrong move, and it's like, why did I do that? And it's like, you're watching that back, and is that kind of frustrating?
Yeah, and so there's two layers to this answer. Is one is like, I'm going to answer for amateurs, and the other is like for professionals, right? So let's say... On the amateur level, yeah, it's super soul crushing. But there is this thing called so in tournament, it is customary to ask your opponent to go over the game after it. So there's a special room with like chess sets, and so you go to this room so that you can talk out loud and not bother the people that keep on playing.
Right.
And it's really, really highly advice to do this, even if you just lost and it's painful, because your opponent, even if it's not, you know, really strong and is your level, is gonna tell you what he thought, and maybe there's like, you know, his own version of things, and it's super interesting to see what he thought and what he thought was his good move, what he thought was good or bad from you. And that's sometimes amateurs, like they're upset or they don't want to do this, but I would highly encourage them to do that. And on the internet, it's about, there's like this feature where only chess, for example, it's free and really easy to use. You can analyze your game straight after. And there's a little button called like train your mistakes. And you get to see the critical moments in the game and actually think, play what was the correct move to play. So that's huge. And and then again, doesn't take much time, but it's about like, you know, if you just play to numb yourself and go game after game after game, you're gonna miss out on this. Now for professionals, you know, they analyze the game in such depth, you know, when they will of course, like the analysis of games is like a huge component, and if you watch, like, you know, they're often like the press conference, it feels like gibberish because they're gonna be like, they're gonna talk about their games and they're going to go like, you know, they're gonna tell about some long variation that they missed or like that they saw, and so, you know, it can feel like a little bit alien when you listen to them, but it's definitely like a huge aspect.
Yeah, for sure. I really like that. I like the fact that you can chat with someone after your game, And even if you lost, you can go through and go through the, you know, where you went wrong. I think that's crucial. Being able to guess, go back and see, you know, what you did wrong, why you did that, what could have gone differently. And I think, you know, a lot of players, even in traditional sport or even in esports or whatever sport it be, neglect that, right? Because, you know, they kind of like, oh, I don't want to go back and look, you know, maybe I did this. But I think, you know, really when you get to that professional level and you're looking at it and you're going like, okay, then that's what makes the difference.
Yeah, and especially because now the computers are so strong. Everyone has all the answers in their pocket. So they're like, I don't want to talk to my opponent. I can just bring my phone and see where I went wrong. But it's really deceptive because it's like, the computer will give you the illusion that you made like this one mistake, but actually they were like, maybe you lost the game on one big tactical mistake, but maybe there was like lots of smaller mistakes that led you to this. And this is what you need to reflect on. It's like everything that led to that one play. And so this is where, like, you know, it's really hard because the any phone is such like at the god level of chess understanding that the draw to just look at this and not talk to your opponent is big, but definitely needs to be resisted.
Yeah, for sure, definitely. And you know, I guess there's a lot of things you can, I guess, draw from that, especially when you are, you know, going through and playing a game, but then it's like, yeah, you made a mistake, okay. But I think, you know, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, that kind of fatigue level. And I think I had a chat with you a little bit earlier regarding the psychobiological model. So, you know, of cognitive fatigue. Yeah. I'd love for you to, you know, kind of explain that a little bit and your thoughts around that.
Yeah, because this is where if you've listened carefully, we've said that there is a big mental fatigue and it's important to be fit. But at the mm-hmm. same time, chess doesn't burn calories. So it's like...
Yeah.
It's like, oh, hold on, how do you reconcile all of this? And you have to realize that actually the mental fatigue comes from like the focus. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's this, it's a buildup of chemicals in your brain. There's like a buildup of adenosine. And yep. and this is like the same process that happens if you do physical sports. So there's this this great recent trend of research exercise physiologist like Samuele Marcora, who's like the big exponent of the psychobiological model, who came up with this like way to explain fatigue. And how does that work? Well, there's like two components to the model, and one is your motivation. And the other is your perception of effort.
Right.
And then it's like about how hard are you going to push yourself when the fatigue comes in, right? Mm-hmm. And if you've got more motivation, of course, you're going to push yourself for longer.
Yep.
That's one of the two components. But now, the second component is the perception of effort. And the perception of effort is actually something that rises through time. I mean, as anyone you know who's been on a jog knows, like if they start jogging at a very comfortable pace, right, after an hour or whatnot or faster, like the perception of effort of this easy jog is going to become harder and harder and harder, right? So this is like really the physiological component of the model. And so you've got this, and so the training brings down the perception of effort, right? Somebody right. that is fitter is gonna bring it down, and Samuele and his colleagues, they've really like done a lot of experimentation because the perception of effort is something that really lives in your brain.
Yeah.
Right. And if you make someone do a hard cognitive task, it's gonna like interfere with this with the physical tasks. So they've done a lot of experiments. I'm trying to explain that as clearly as possible. That they really like a lot of data that shows that really the fatigue that you get from the endurance is of the same nature that the fatigue you get from focusing, right? So this is why, like, you know, I think by doing a lot of sport and pushing away the point at which you feel the fatigue, mm-hmm. it's also pushing away the point at which you feel the fatigue when you focus.
Right.
So I think this is a critical. This is all like work in progress. But when the more I think about this, that this is like kind of like, yeah, I think I really think they're onto something, and yeah. this is why the fitness works so well for this. And maybe one day they will reverse, because they're like, they're also using cognitive fatigue for endurance athletes to make them like push themselves harder. So maybe one day the cyclists will be playing chess mm-hmm. for 2 hours before their training session to push their point of fatigue. So it's really a fascinating area, and there's lots of current research, and I'm really looking mm-hmm. at this with a great interest.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I love the area of fatigue, because it's prevalent in so many areas, right? Like not even just sports, but also just normal work life, where we kind of tired ourselves out in all different tasks, just because of that kind of focus, differentiation between actually focusing, but then also understanding that underlying motivation towards that work. So I think there's so much interesting area that's, you know, being explored there. And especially within, you know, chess and esports, the research is just going to get greater and greater, which is going to be a lot more beneficial for all of us.
Yeah, definitely. Like what they're really researching is like more like what's happening in the brain, where how does this transfer is being yep. done. It's still like an open area of research, but I think the building blocks are really compelling for the whole model.
For sure, definitely. Now, before we start to turn off the gas and roll down the hill for the end, there's one thing I wanted to also chat with you about, which we kind of had a chat over Discord about, was this kind of idea of finite and infinite games.
Yeah, definitely. So
yeah.
This is something from James Cass, who was like, he was like an academic. I think he was studying religions, and I think he unfortunately passed away last year. And he wrote this book about finite and infinite games. And I think, you know, the game that you play as an esport player or a chess player, that's the finite game. You know, there's win and loss, but mm-hmm. you have to think, the athletes have to think themselves as more playing the infinite game. What's an infinite game? An infinite game is when you really have no problems to change the rule of the game to keep it going.
Right.
So, of course, there's no such thing as a truly infinite game in real life, but you see the idea is like, okay, As an esport player, mm-hmm. you need to play the infinite game with your career, right? Mm. You want to be healthy to have a long career, and maybe if it's over, you want to be a streamer or a coach or something else, or even change careers. And yeah. and this is the infinite game that you have to think of. And I think this is where us coaches are there to help them, play this infinite game, as in making them, healthy, well-rounded individual that will go. And the interventions that we make, I think, have to go beyond the win or loss of the next playoff.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's very difficult to introduce that idea, but I love the idea, because you know, I guess if you said that to a 14, 15-year-old player who's just entering esports, it's kind of like, well, yeah, okay. But then if you kind of chat with more of an older esports player who's, you know, mid-20s, early 30s even, I think they would kind of understand that idea of holistically positioning yourself into a such place where you are able to sustain yourself in terms of longevity, right? Because, you know, at the end of the day, we have some esports players that are retiring at the age of 22, and I'm like, well, you know, we shouldn't probably be retiring that early. And I think, you know, being able to think about it in the long run is probably the most important characteristic to really take into account.
Yeah, 100%. That's why I wanted to. I know that the subject of, like, you know, early retirement is important in esports. That's why I really wanted to bring up that topics. And for young players, you know, they might not know or understand why they have to, you know, exercise and sleep well and everything. But it's about, you know, make them do it, even if they don't realize that, you know, they're not in touch with their own mortality yet.
Yeah.
You know, when you're young, you just really feel that you know, nothing can happen, and it's up and up from there. But, you know, once you get a little bit older, and maybe you have, like, health problems, you realize that you know, it's just something like fragile and precious and beautiful, and you need to be respectful of life and just do things that will be good for you going forward. And so maybe they won't understand, but as a coach, whichever way you can get buy-in and make them do something that is impactful, and maybe one day in 5 years, 10 years, they will understand, like, I understand now why we had to do X, Y, Z, and why they were focused on sleep and so on. Then that's a win for the coach.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I think that was such a, you know, beautiful way to, I guess, kind of summarize our chat today and our episode.
Fantastic.
You know, I think it's really important to, you know, look at sports kind of holistically within yourself, but then also within the future as well, because it's about, you know, being competitive, being the best version of yourself, and, you know, kind of gradually over time sculpting that mold of who you want to be within the scene. Because, you know, obviously, you know, we're not going to be able to maintain our performance for forever. There's going to be increases, there's going to be decreases. That's inevitable, right? So I guess being able to come to reason with that and acknowledge that helps you to develop that understanding that we can prepare for it. And I think being able to do that is going to make you a better chess player, esports player, traditional sports player, whatever it might be, just individual as a whole.
Definitely. Yeah. That's a beautiful conclusion.
I guess for everyone listening, you know, if we wanted to reach out to you in regards to chess or any questions, are you active on any social media or not really?
Yeah, definitely. I just started a Twitter account recently. It's at Benji Porto. I guess the spelling is tricky, so maybe we put it in the show notes.
I'll put it in the notes,
And there you can get in touch with me.
Fantastic, for sure. I'm sure that, you know, I know there's a couple of people who are really interested in this episode, so hopefully, you get a couple of messages when this goes live.
Thank you so much, Lachlan. It was really a pleasure to be on the show and a fantastic dialogue.
No worries. Thank you very much, Benjamin, for coming on. It was fantastic to really kind of understand different elements of chess that I actually hadn't thought about before, from, you know, long to short games, the psychobiological model of understanding fatigue, because it's so prevalent, and really just understanding chess, you know, from someone like yourself as a whole.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.